Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhnt.
When I talk about Double Diamond with business people, then that's sometimes tough for them to understand how this process description is connected to the actual business values and stuff like that. Is there something special about your process phases which incorporates stakeholders in a better way?
I would say definitely. The discover phase is kind of similar. And the graphic, if you look at it, Double Diamond has discover, define, and then comes the word develop. They don't mean developing an engineer. They mean developing their concept. And their delivery isn't delivering a product. It's delivering something to the client and then saying, have a nice day, enjoy the prototype. So that's very different than what I think the professional responsibility should be of a UX designer.
It's timeless, scalable design process. So what makes it timeless? An industry that changes quite every 6 months with new tools and AI coming up and stuff like that.
It's funny because I just last week wrote an article on agentic design. Actually, agentic design should be following actually more timeless design methods. It's not how you design or what you're designing with that we're talking about. It's the designerly way of knowing, the designer way of thinking. That kind of makes me draw back on the great design thinkers such as Herbert Simon, The Art of the Artificial, Donald Schoen, the reflective practitioner, Christopher Alexander. These have people who have really set the standard for the way that we should be designing, the way we think about design, the way we think we should be designing, not so much design thinking, but design doing.
We thank our sponsor, Codeword Customer Consulting GmbH, your coaching partner in the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership. Are you a UX professional seeking to level up your career? Then let's get in touch for one-on-one mentoring or individual CV and portfolio reviews. Find our contact details in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you today.
Hello to Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, your compass through the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership and UX maturity. The show for managers and directors, leading teams of experienced designers, researchers, and concept developers. I'm your host, Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhnt, and today we have an extended deep dive episode on a topic that is fundamental to our success as leaders, the process. To guide us through this, I'm thrilled to have Jonathan Arnowitz, Principal Design Consultant at Keen Design, as guest today. He has authored a fantastic series on what they call or he calls the timeless, scalable design process, which is also available as blog post at Keen Design's website. And yeah, we are going to unpack it all for you today. So, Jonathan, welcome back to the show. I'm thrilled to talk to you again. I just looked it up before. It's been really 2 years already since we talked last time here in this podcast. So great to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Yeah. So before we jump into the framework itself, maybe you can tell our listeners a bit about your journey that led you here, about your professional career, and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
Certainly. Okay, so my name is Jonathan Arnowitz. I'm the principal designer at Keen Design in Utrecht in the Netherlands. As you could probably tell from my gray hairs, I've been at design for quite a long time, for 30 plus years, where I've worked for such companies as Google, IBM, as well as startups and design agencies as well. And most of the places I've gone to have included not just design, but also design management. And I've been responsible for implementing design processes and also creating design infrastructure as well in many of the companies I've worked in. And one of the things that I have done throughout my career that is these design processes. And so I began to see a common thread that's worked from one company to another, and that has kind of developed into this kind of scalable design process. Timeless because it's something that's based on the timeless design way of working. Think of, for example, the designerly way of working by Nigel Cross. Scalable because it expands and contracts to your needs or to your restrictions, let's say, as well.
Yeah, so what were some of the pain points throughout your career that you experienced that made you think in more detail about those processes?
Yes. Well, I would see a repeatable process that, especially among senior designers who are very eager and have a very strong ideas, when they can come to very quick judgments and they think very early on, oh, I know the answer, and they want to jump right into the solution. You need a way to get someone to step back and say, wait a minute, there's still some questions we need to ask. There's still things we don't know. That's not a question of competence. It's a question of good process. And that's especially necessary. You would think like, oh, a designer with a lot of experience wouldn't need this, but it's actually quite the opposite. They're the ones who probably need it the most, because they're the ones most likely to quickly jump into solution mode, when actually you first need to do things like reframing the question, questioning what you think people are saying, and looking at the question behind the question, these things that the good design process assures that we do.
Mm. Yeah, often also when we design products, so I work in automotive industry, and usually development is very feature driven. And just recently somebody said about design process which start with research and user needs and stuff like that. So they're doing it the wrong way, but it's just the opposite. If you start with features first, then you're doing it the wrong way. Experienced people might to forget.
Yeah, and it's easy to get caught up in that, because people start, they talk enthusiastically, oh, it has to do this and it has to do that. And you don't step back and first ask, well, wait a minute, why are we trying to do this? What problem are we trying to solve? And very often when you start getting into a feature discussion that precedes first asking, what is it we're trying to solve? You'll come up with a massive design creep, a scope creep, because there's no measurement to say like, well, what's enough? And the temptation is, let's do as much as the competition. And again, it's like, first step back and answer what it is you're trying to do and solve a problem. Don't build a feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what the process tries to let you do.
Yes. So coming back to the name you gave the process, it's timeless, scalable design process. So what makes it timeless in your view, in an industry that changes quite every 6 months with new tools and AI coming up and stuff like that? How can a process be timeless in those times? Yes.
It's funny, because I have just last week wrote an article on agentic design and how I actually agentic design should be following actually more timeless design methods, because it's not how you design or what you're designing with that we're talking about. It's the designerly way of knowing, the designer way of thinking. That kind of makes me draw back on the great design thinkers such as Herbert Simon, The Art of the Artificial, Donald Schoen, the Reflective Practitioner, Christopher Alexander. These have people who have really set the standard for the way that we should be designing, the way we think about design, the way we think we should be designing, not so much design thinking, but design doing. And it really goes wrong when we abandon those precepts. And there's a lot of pressure to do so. There's a lot of artificial deadlines because people want to see things really quickly. There's a lot of pressure to try, it's going to cost too much if we do a process. And, can't you just do this? And trying to get people to be a team player, you know, just do it the way I want you to do it, without people's design profession really being respected. And what makes it timeless is it looks at the ways that a process should respect the way a designer works. And if you're not going to respect the way a designer works, then you really don't need a designer.
Uh-huh.
And so it doesn't ask anything other than what is good standard design, which is what you should be doing anyway. One senior designer told me, he said, what he loved about the design, but what made it for him timeless is it's like, regardless of whether it's a big or a small project, it's like this checklist that he can go through and say, okay, yeah, I've done that. Oh, no, I didn't do that. Let me go and do that. So it was always a way of kind of enforcing your professional responsibilities and your professional criteria.
So it's really more about thinking about the why you do things and not that much how you do it, actually. The how can maybe or corresponds to a project size or industry or whatsoever.
And the moment you start and prescribing how you do it, that's when the problems start. That's when you're suddenly shoeholing you into something, into a product that's not going to scale. Because a method that's good for one thing is not good for everything, A. B, I think it's an essential designer skill to use their brains and their experience to say, like, okay, for this part of the design phase, I need to do X, Y, and Z because of the special conditions. The contexts of designs are, of a design project are so innumerous. It's not like, oh, there's this type of design or that type of design project. Every design project's like a fingerprint. And it really needs a designer to decide how it's going to be done. But you don't need to design what should be done. That's already decided.
Mm, yeah.
That structure.
Yes, yes, I see. And now let's talk a little bit about the scalable part of your process. So can you give us some concrete examples of how projects scale up or down with the model, or how the model or process can be adapted to certain projects, and how does it affect things like team composition or timelines? How then can this be scaled to the project needs?
So what makes it scalable is the separation of how you do it with what you should do it. And what you should do is that we express in the form of the goals. What are the goals of a design phase? For example, in discovery, what you have to do is any designer wants to be able to reframe the question. So first you need a question, then you have to have a series of exercises in order to reframe it. That reframing then can go anywhere from taking the CEO aside and having a 20-minute conversation with them to, for a broader project, having to have multiple stakeholders in a table in a workshop where you're actually going to do some product definitional or project innovation work, and that's going to be a much broader effort with a lot more people that are involved in the project. But it's the idea is that it just scales to that goal. What do you need to do to perform that goal? That will determine who you're going to do it with, who you need to include, and the scope and how long it will take.
So is my understanding correct that each phase that you defined has a certain goal which needs to be reached, sort of?
That is correct. So there's a... those are the ones. So there are things that we call timeless goals. So those are the goals that every phase should have. Every discovery phase, for example. So in the discover phase, every phase should reframe the design challenge, as I mentioned earlier. Another thing is that you probably need to establish the requirements, things that everybody should do, that needs to do. In addition to that, there could be other goals that are specific to a project. So a project may want to also create, like, for example, let's say that this is also a project where there's not been a competitive analysis. So a goal is also, let's say, add a competitive analysis to our goal. So by having these goals specific to each phase, you then know when the phase is over. You know that the phase is, well, that's also a very interesting idea. We know when you've met the needs of the phase. When I say the phase is over, of course, this is design. In design, nothing's really over because we don't iterate in steps. We iterate in cycles. So very often, you make the discovery phase. And then in the next phase, the concept phase, you've learned something new. And with the new learning, suddenly your understanding in the discovery phase becomes outdated. And it becomes, if you don't take that into consideration, then people think, oh my God, you're redoing everything. I thought we just established this. But if it's an expected part of the iterative cycle, people get more comfortable. Everything's in hand. This is exactly the way it is supposed to work. And it's the way it's supposed to, this is the way a designer works.
Yes, I see. We talked about the concept phase, discovery phase, first concept phase. So what are the other phases that you defined in your process? I think we haven't explained that yet in detail.
Oh, yes. Right. So there are four phases. There's the discover phase, the concept phase, detail, and then delivery. And so discover phase, that is kind of the discovery of where you decide what it is. That's where you discover what you're going to design and how you're going to design it. You're going to also discuss, you know, a project plan comes under discovery, reframing the issue comes under that, requirements, critical success factors, OKRs, if you're doing value-driven design, that comes under discovery. Then in concept, that's when you do the conceptual design, where you take the design challenge, as it's stated in the discovery, and then come up with 5 to 10 design concepts where you try to create a conceptual model that meets the needs of the business that is then going to map to the mental model of your users. And you'll do that iteratively in a what we would call formative research phase, where you would synthesize these 5 concepts into a single concept. And with that, and with it, the idea is that with the rich ideas and the synthesis, you're going to have a much superior product than had you just picked one direction and saw that out to the bitter end. Then when you have that conceptual design, you have a solid design direction, then comes details. And then in the detail design, that is kind of where we're now, we're in new territory if you compare our design process, say, to the Double Diamond process, because Double Diamond would really end at what we would call the conceptual design phase. Because in the detail design phase, that's where there's a closer working with engineering to create the details that are actually going to be created in the product. So you're working not just on doing detailed design, you're probably working very closely with sprint planning, sprint management, as well as with, you know, the scrum masters, so that you coordinate with engineering what it is you're going to do, what and when you're going to develop, so you develop to them what they need and when they need it. Then comes the delivery phase. And the delivery phase is when detailed design is pretty much over. You've pretty much finished the designs that you need to design. And then very often, some designers and some design agencies say, well, my work's done. I've done my thing. I can now leave. The fact is, that could be some of the most gnarly and creative design work still left to be done. Because now that you've delivered a design, the developer now has to implement it. And I've never met a developer that could just flawlessly implement what you've designed. There's always going to be technical things that will come up. There will be, the tool that I have, I thought it could do this, it actually can't. This platform doesn't work that way. And you have to come up with alternatives. And it's not just coming up with any alternative. If you're not there, the developer will come up with an alternative themselves. And they'll do their best, but they're not a designer. They don't know the concept. And they'll end up with something that will look like Frankenstein's monster instead of what it should be, which is a refinement of the concept and something that's actually is an improvement on what has gone on previous designs. So it tries to fight the idea that in the delivery phase, that what should happen are workarounds. They shouldn't be workarounds. They should be better refinements. And so that you're actually continuously improving the design, because the delivery phase, as we all know, is actually probably going to be the longest phase, because there isn't really going to be an end to most development. Most development, now we're living in a day of continuous release, continuous improvement, and continuous development. So, and with that comes continuous design. And that is the need for the very strong, very strong and continually refined concept, because it's got to have legs to go for a very long time. And if it's not a robust concept, it's not going to be able to see people through the delivery process.
Yeah,
yeah. That's the phases.
Yeah, great, great. Thanks for this overview. Yeah, indeed, it reminded me of Double Diamond at first. But now I think I got quite a bit of the difference. But when I talk about Double Diamond with business people, then that's sometimes also tough for them to understand how this process description is connected to the actual business right. values and stuff like that. So is there something special about your process phases with which incorporates stakeholders in a better way, maybe?
I would say definitely. The discover phase is kind of similar to we both kind of approach discover the same way. However, the double diamond, what you should remember about the double diamond is its background is in graphic design, and the Design Council is a very graphic design driven organization until late. And the graphic, if you look at it, the double diamond has discover, define, and then comes the word develop, mm-hmm. and then comes deliver. But they don't mean developing or an engineer. They mean developing their concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And their delivery isn't delivering a product. It's delivering something to the client and then saying, have a nice day, enjoy the prototype, mm-hmm. I'm done with my work. Mm-hmm. So that's very different than what I think the professional responsibility should be of a UX designer. A UX designer's responsibility is not at the end of delivery. Again, think of the graphic design origins where after their design was done, it went to a printing press. Mm. And then they would probably look over the comps and say, yep, that fits, or oh, there's some color corrections, but that was really it. But that's not the case with user experience design. User experience design uses a much longer ramp of work and is more the implementation partner. I mean, no one would really say that the graphic designer is a printing press operator's partner. I mean, they would go, what are you doing here? Go away. Yeah. But with UX design, it really requires a totally different stakeholder involvement. And probably, I think if you look in the articles I talk about, we're not doing what some people would call user-centered design, or some people would call customer-centered design, other people call human-centered design. What we're really looking at is stakeholder-centered design. And you got to take a very complex network of competing interests and know how to harmonize those into a single unified smooth product. And that's starting with, you know, if you're working for a business, you're looking at, you know, the business, what's the business goal of this product? And the user may want to do something else, but if it doesn't serve the ends goals of that product, then they're not going to have a product. It's not going to. So what you want to do is find ways to do what I call transforming of values. So the user has a value, the customer has a value, there's a business value. You want that business value transformed into a way that the customer wants, and then transformed the way that the user would want to work. For example, let's say that the a bank has a goal to raise their loan rate by 25%. Well, the user doesn't have that's not really the user doesn't have that goal. They don't have an OKR in their home finances to say, yeah, I want to increase my loans by 25%. What they do is, however, maybe homeowners really want to refinance their mortgages. So all of a sudden you find a way to then translate. Okay, so we're not talking about loans. We're talking about for this user group, refinancing a mortgage, and use that as an inroad to, you know, get into loans. So that's kind of it's that kind of recognition of it's a negotiation among different layers of values, of competing interests, if you will, to make a harmonious product.
Mm-hmm. This negotiation already has to start in the discovery phase, I assume, because already in that phase, maybe some business people have certain targets on the markets, and then engineers might already be involved in those phases. If you think of continuous development cycles, then they might have some technical concerns already. So how do you facilitate this resolution in the very beginning of the discovery phase already.
Well, that's actually the beauty of the project of this approach is very early on you flesh out what those differences are, and very early on you get a way to you can engage with, like, for example, that a manager, an engineering manager says, well, we have a lot of technical debt. We don't want to do any feature requests this quarter. And the product or the business says, no, we got to push out this new feature. Well, that sounds like a turf war. I say this and you say that. But however, if instead you go, you look at this more in the terms of process, and you look at, okay, we have these two competing interests. How do we transform this interest into a working product, into a working process for a product? Then you can say, instead of saying, oh, I can't do this or I can, you said, oh, you can, but maybe if we delay our technical debt, we can do an implementation. However, this would have to get rewritten. So are you willing to take on that extra cost? On the other hand, are you willing to live with a delay of, say, 2 months for us to get our technical debt down and then to release your product? And then all of a sudden you're negotiating, you're having that conversation. What also helps, and this is also important, why the designer's there. What do you need the designer for? Very often they use the stakeholders, they see things from their own perspective. And I think the beauty of a designer is their ability to bring together all of those perspectives and doing something like, for example, visualizing things, for example, in concept models, concept maps, where suddenly you visualize what the problem is. So for things that are just kind of theoretical in the heads of people, suddenly they see it in black and white and in a diagram, they realize, oh, that's not so bad as I thought it was. Or maybe they said, oh, God, there's much. I didn't realize that's what I was asking. So you really can visualize, and that really helps people make tangible what the problem is. It's like, you know, technical debt, that doesn't mean anything to a product person. And the engineer, when they talk about features, they're not thinking about profits. They're talking about that's a lot of work. So the models are a way of really the designer's ability to bring people together and see what each party is talking about, and then begin that negotiation.
Yeah. So the designer is in the end also a facilitator for, getting definitely the discovery phase to a certain goal or a gate which can then pass or so.
And think about, you know, the work that entails. You don't often think about that unless you have the process in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's very often you can easily dive into that turf war. That's a very seductive thing, going, what do you mean you can't do this? I'd say, but when you have the process before you, you realize, okay, hold it. Let's look at this now from these different perspectives. Let's see if we can unify unify our vision and get a shared idea of what it is each other's saying and what the ramifications are of what that means. And that's the beauty of the process. It makes sure that step happens, when sometimes it's very tempting to, gee, I don't know if I want to get involved in that.
Okay, so let's assume now all the negotiations in discovery phase are done. Everybody's happy with the result. Gate is passed. Then concept phase starts. So what is the goal here in the concept phase? And what can typically also maybe go wrong in that phase based on your experience? And how can the process help to solve that?
Well, again, the what can go wrong is to quote the Stephen King, the famous author, you have to learn how to kill your darlings. And what he meant by that is the first thing you think of, and I don't know how many times I've done this myself, I think of this like, I got it. It's just, it's great. It's great. It does everything. I'm sure this is going to be perfect. And you just fall in love with your idea. And I remember my first, and then you show it in peer review and people go, huh, what? That's what is that? What are you trying to? And then that's kind of that reality check that you really need. But if you don't have that peer review, or you don't in your process, and you don't have that check, that can just, oh, we don't need five. We don't need five concepts. This one they'll just do. Or what I've also seen is, okay, this is such a great concept, we'll do five variations on this same concept. So you really need to you really need to be the humble designer. Check your your ego at the door and really come up with different competing visions, competing designs, designs from other people. I know there's a lot of designers who say like, oh, these engineers, they come up with these crazy ideas. Well, I think if you really look at a good design process, a process wants to encourage ideas, no matter where they're from. Engineers can have some fantastic ideas, or sometimes they have really rotten ideas, but they bring up something that's actually, they bring up a point that you have to deal with. And you would never have had that point to deal with if they weren't given the freedom to give that idea. Ideas are kind of the oxygen of design. Mm-hmm. And so what the concept phase is really about is getting as much oxygen, as much ideas into that concept as you can in the beginning. Because what's going to make that a solid concept is the ideas that it is supporting. So if you have, for example, let's take a design rationale. If you have your concept that's supported by one design rationale, that means in one instance, suddenly that design, your design is no longer relevant. If it's supported by five different rationales, so there's five reasons why you're doing it. If one falls away, the others are still valid, and you have a stronger concept. That's a concept that will do, instead of one thing, it's doing five things at once, because they have five design rationales. That's what's, you really want to build a concept that has that kind of sturdiness, that kind of gravitas, that it's really going to survive the battering that it's about to get in the next phase.
Yeah, so, and would concept phase also include already some tangible prototypes, which also can then be tested already, or would that be done later?
Yes, so again, you want to come up with, like I said, usually 5 to 10 concepts. You get the idea that, I mean, classically speaking, you have 10 concepts, you synthesize that to 3, then you synthesize that to 1, and then you've got, if you do the math, you've got, almost 50 ideas in that prototype. How do you do that? Again, that's getting into the why or the how or the method. Certainly, I don't see how you can get around visualizing it. You can't keep things abstract forever. You can do as many models as you want to help people to understand what it is you're trying to do. But in the end, you probably want to do some sort of a visualization. So it could be a sketch, it could be a drawing, it could be a prototype, it could be a coded prototype, a vibed prototype now, since we can now just tell a computer what we want it to do, as long as you don't try it to look too closely at the interaction that they come up with now. But there's ways to very rapidly prototype now, so the temptation is to rapidly come up with a prototype. In general, if I give guidance about, well, what you should consider, whatever tool you use, that is going to determine how conservative your design is going to be. Because if your tool doesn't do this great, wonderful, innovative thing you're going to do, you can't prototype it. And you end up, what you really don't want to do is you then stand, okay, I'm going to use this tool, and you just then make something that makes that tool fit. And that's also a really what I don't like about companies that say like, oh, you have to use, you know, Figma, or you have to use this, because it's really going to limit what you're going to be able to design, what you're going to be able to come up with. Having said that, people should come up with whatever they think will work in that project. But the answer, that's a long way of saying yes, they should visualize
it. Yeah, yeah. To my experience, when you in that phase, when you already have quite realistically looking tangible products, people discuss often about the wrong problems. So they do not discuss really about the concept or the ideas behind it, but maybe how a button looks like, or the yes. color of the home screen or something like that. So
that's the problem. That's what I call the fidelity problem. Mm-hmm. You go to a level of fidelity you're actually not ready to show. Mm-hmm. Then what happens? And actually, the worst offender is visual design, because 9 times out of 10, no matter how sophisticated a non-UX stakeholder is, they'll look at something and think that's it. Mm-hmm. And how many times I've seen a designer say, no, 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 don't look at the colors. It's the interaction I'm talking about. Yeah, but the colors really, mm-hmm. the color is such a grabber that you really want to make sure that you are ready to show at the level of fidelity that you're going to actually build to in a way that makes sense For example, let's say that there are a set of icons that you've built up. It's a family of icons, but they really don't make sense until you can really click on them and interact with them. Then you'll kind of get them right away what they are. But if you just see a picture of them, you'll look at, huh, what are they? You probably don't want to show that family of icons in a static demo, in a wireframe. Probably a bad idea. Probably better to use placeholders. But again, you got to be able to read the situation. You know, the designer says it depends, because then there's the one CEO who just can't understand anything if it's not colored in for him. Mm-hmm. Going, huh? What's that? Oh, now I get it. So it's the trade-off of, you know, knowing what level of fidelity that your audience is going to need. But you're spot on. Going into too great a detail will get you into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Okay, so now next phase is a detail phase, right?
Yeah. So yes. The detail phase. So that in the concept phase, you've exited the concept with a solid concept. It's and not only that, you've done formative testing with users and with customers, if you have customers, and so that you have a the confidence that this is a winning concept. It's not like, well, let's try this and see what happens. No, you know that this is, you're willing to bet the bank now. You're saying, no, I've done my due diligence. I know this is going to work. And now in the detail phase, this is, oddly enough, the phase, some people think concepts is where all the creativity is. And I would disagree. I think 90% of the creativity actually comes in details. That's where we get the saying, depending on which side of the coin you're on, the devil is in the details. Yeah. Or after you've done it, when you've finished everything, then you say God is in the details, because suddenly you have this fit and finish that is amazing. And it's the concept is a raw concept. The fit and finish, what it really is, that's going to be in the detail phase. And that's where the rubber meets the road. That's when you thought of all these great ideas and concept, and in reality, something else shows its ugly head that you can't do, and then you have to reiterate on the concept. And that's a good thing, because then you're making the concept stronger, because here's a problem that we've got new knowledge. Again, it's about to follow this process and make the process work. You have to look at it as a learning process. So it's not, oh, we've discredited what we've learned already. No, we've enriched what we've learned already. This is new information. So let's not look at, oh, they want to go right, so now let's go left. It's like, no, they also want to go to both directions. How do we synthesize that into the process in a way that works, that is in constant with the concept that you have? Very hard to do, but oh so rewarding when you're done, because that's when you get the I can't say the iPhone anymore because of that glass, but let's not go down there. But yeah. You know, the original iPhone had a fit and finish to it, as did like the, you know, the click wheel iPad, iPod rather. It just had a click. Every detail was thought about, and that's because of a discipline in the concept from concept to detail, that you're going to do things that are loyal to the concept, because there's a reason why you did the concept. There's a lot of work that went into that. And again, so in the concept phase, you've done things like you have that overall concept, so you can break that down into epics for engineers. So you're usually working with engineers then for already to plan the sprints in Agile. You want to make sure that you coordinate that engineering gets the pieces they need when they're planning it. But that's a two-way road, because engineering may want something, but you actually aren't ready, because there's actually a key test that's going to happen. You have to wait a month for some scheduling reason that you can't do anything about. So then you've got to negotiate and say, well, we can't do that until then. What can we do in the meantime? What else do you need? I mean, there's got to be something else. It's not like that's the only part of the application. So if you engage in the Scrum Master, especially if the Scrum Masters usually are very cooperative and wanting to make sure that this is a smooth running sprint, so they'll want to find something that you can actually deliver. And no engineer wants you to deliver something that you're going to redo a couple sprints down the road. So usually this good two-way negotiation happens at the beginning of concept and then is realized during detail.
Oh, okay.
And then in detail, that starts kind of if you're doing Agile, and And I say this in a caveat because I've never seen Agile done quite the same way twice in any company I've ever worked for. But there will be some coordination of what's going on as in design and what's going on in Agile, so that you're coordinating what you're delivering with what they need to build. That is not to say that you are working in Agile yourself, because I believe that's not the way a designer works. A designer works on the entire artifact. But the idea is that a designer with this process has kind of like a trifocal lens. They can see 5 years out in the future what they're going to build. They can see what they're going to need at the end of the year, and they know what they got to do this sprint. And they're able to kind of say, oh, yeah, is this right? Yeah. And they're able to kind of like, you know, do this up and down like I do with my trifocal glasses to make sure they know what they're doing now is going to be sustainable in the future. That's in detail. And then in the delivery phase, that's when you work that's when you're really doing a lot of evaluations of sprint evaluations of late release software. When I mean late release, you've worked with the developers already and the engineers in the detail phase. So you're not strangers to each other, and there's not many surprises. And the ones that are usually quite minor, although there's been some doozy exceptions to that rule. Nevertheless, that's when you kind of handhold delivery so that delivery remains true to the concept and doesn't go off building a Frankenstein's monster. And then that goes on. It doesn't go on forever, because we know at one point that concept is going to grow old and die like all concepts. And then you're going to want to start the process over again.
Mm. So talking about the role of the design leaders. So does this role change throughout the process? I assume in the beginning they are more like those facilitators and steer the negotiations between stakeholders. So what's the role of the design leaders, let's say, in the detail phase? Do they step back and now the individual contributors more take over, or is this so? What's the changing role here for the design leaders?
Yeah, I think what you'll see is it's kind of like a gradient, if you will, that, you know, maybe it also depends what you talk about as a design leader. If you're talking about like the lead conceptual designer, they probably have a gradient that goes very dark to very light. And an individual contributor, you know, maybe production designer, is very light in the beginning, then gets darker and darker until they're working. But in general, that leader is probably going to be the keeper of the flame in the delivery phase. They're not out of the picture, but they shouldn't. They should have done a good enough handoff that they're not needing to handhold anybody. Plus, in a good team, everyone's kind of, they should be able to run themselves. They understand, they get that there's good information. It's a shared concept. The process is designed to be collaborative, so everyone understands is on the same page. When it comes to design management, however, and that form of leadership, they really need to manage stakeholder management, because there will be those little tight deadlines will prop up. Oh, here's the latest thing we got to add right away, and you got to be able to intercede. It's not like you can protect, you know, you could say like, no, you're not going to do that. That's just not reality. But you have to be able to do it in a rational way, because even the person who wants to jam in this last minute feature for whatever business critical reason, they don't want to destroy the product. So there's still going to be negotiation room. Let's do this the right way. Whereas if you're not there, it'll just get, you know, bolted on. And the next thing you know, it's, when the product releases, you look at it, go, whoa, what happened here? So design management is probably a constant, but conceptual design and individual contributors, there's probably a heaviness of conceptual design in the beginning and heaviness on individual contributor individual contributor and production design at the end.
So stakeholder management, you would say, is also important in delivery phase until the very end, or not
to the very end.
To the very end, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, because stakeholders don't behave. designers don't behave. Why would you expect another stakeholder to behave? So we all want to, like, you know, do the right thing. But we have our own definition about what that right thing is, and what's right for product may not be good for engineering, definitely not good for design. So let's try to make whatever last minute changes that come, let's make that a win-win as much as we can. So you definitely have to do continual stakeholder management. Also, because there's also stakeholders you're not involved in all the stakeholders. So here's some new marketing person or another product person from another group who has this idea, and they're used to working in a totally different way. So yeah, you always have to, don't let go for a second. Don't drop that thread for a second.
Yeah, good advice, definitely. So in the beginning, you briefly mentioned OKRs and value-driven design. So
oh, great.
Yeah. So I would like to come back to this topic because it's also, I think, important also for managing such processes. So how about when you use value-driven design and you define some OKRs, how would you, for example, connect like a smaller UI choice, maybe which is discussed in the detail phase, to high-level business OKRs? So this is sometimes a connection which is hard to explain also to stakeholders, I think.
Yeah. And the key difference with value-driven design is a matter of, on the one hand, metrics, because you have UX metrics, and one of my favorite things to see in a usability test, and I've seen it so many times, there'll be someone will do a task. At the end of the task, they'll then give the user a Likert scale. How much did you enjoy that task? And of course, doing it right after the task, assuming they've completed it, you're going to get a success bias, and it's going to get a high number. And it's like, okay, now you've got a number. So let's say you go to you do a report, and you say, yeah, our usability during our usability test, we got a satisfaction score of 5.6. Well, is that good or is that bad? You can argue both ways. It could be good, but it could also be bad. Mm-hmm. There's no way. There's nothing really to tell you what does good and what does bad mean. Value-driven design tries to solve that by moving it to an objective plane, that you have business objectives on the highest level, that there's a business objective, or if you're not a business, an organizational objective that is paramount. It's the reason why you're doing it. You're spending money on this product or this service for this reason, to achieve this end. Then you want to take that metric and you want to then transform that down to the different stakeholders. So for example, example I said about the bank that wants to increase loans, and they want to increase loans by 30%, and the user certainly doesn't want to do that, but they do want to refinance their home. And if you so then there you can imagine then product and design then have a fight. Product says, I want a apply for loan button there. And you say, no, I want there to be apply for a mortgage button there. And that sounds like a turf war. I say this, you say that, I own the product, I own the design. Who's going to win that? The engineer, because they're the last ones who are going to touch the thing, right? But now with the OKR, what's going to result in a higher percentage of loan conversions? It's not going to be that loan button. With user research that more people are more likely to print to click on a finance button as opposed to an apply loan button or another profile, they're more likely to click on a car loan. You can actually then have a design rationale that goes from a metric on your on a percentage of how likely they are to click on it that rolls all the way up to a business level OKR. So suddenly that button is no longer a religious war that you talk about. Suddenly there's very powerful evidence that this is a much better approach to achieve your business objectives. And that's all. And I've literally heard customers say, like, you know, that's what we like about value-driven design, because it shows me the business value that I get from that button.
Mm.
That's the power of what value-driven design does with using OKRs as the core metrics.
So this connection, how much value this button actually brings, is this based on empirical, or has this to be based on empirical data, or what do you do if you work on a new project where such data is not available? So how can you then actually make this connection?
Well, that's what user research is for.
Okay. Yes.
So that you have user research, and you have various, you don't necessarily need a usability test. You could also do user interviews. There's a lot of different cognitive walkthroughs. You can do a lot of different things to get data that will point you in a certain direction, and especially because the early research will point in a different direction, but later research, which will be more concrete, will verify that.
Yeah,
or verify it or correct it. One of the two. It can also be a correction. As you learn more, you learn more, and there's honor in learning. So you can't say like, "Oh, I was wrong." No, that was a reasonable assumption to make based on the data we had. We have better data now. We have this, but the result will nevertheless, whether that initial assumption was right or wrong, you have better evidence now to point to business value than you had to begin with.
Yeah. So in the end, it has to be based on empirical data for a new product coming from user research, for, let's say, established product coming from actual user data, for example.
Yeah, especially since Steve Jobs is dead. I think that's probably a fair assumption. Otherwise it's just, the loudest voice wins.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole point of a good design process, and indeed the value-driven design, as well as even just the more generic, timeless, scalable one, you want to remove all design decisions from a subjective plane to an objective plane. Mm-hmm. Because that's where you win the design. It's not because on the subjective plane, you're not going to convince the CEO that blue's not his favorite color.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But you can show, nobody knows how to use that blue button. Just saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So now let's get a bit more like tactical for the leaders who are listening. Mm-hmm. So what would be your first piece of advice for our leaders who are listening and who want to apply your process? Maybe even if the team pushes back, maybe seeing it just as another, jargon kind of thing. So what would be your advice for our leaders here?
Yeah, I think especially when I look at the implementation, even at Keen, it's like you're going to tell, senior designers how about a process. It's like, well, I have the double diamond. Thank you very much. But, I already know, the double diamond only is going to take you so far. What do you do? And you look at their pain points. You see what pain points they have right now. And almost everyone complains about the fact that they're not really practicing their profession. The product manager's making decisions before I, they're telling me, oh, it's got to work this way, but that's my job. I should be able to figure that out. And I don't think that's right. So I'm out of the loop of making decisions. Sometimes a designer will say like, oh, I feel like a pixel pusher. I'm not really allowed to be creative. Well, this is supposed to reinstill that creativity, give you back that power, empower you, bring you back to the strategy table. So when product's supposed to be making that decision, you're there and you're saying, okay, have you also thought of X, Y, and Z? And instead of there being a turf war saying, I said this and you said that, now you're at the table and you're able to be a designer. The other thing that I think is very important is you look at the design concept, especially if you look at my at the article. I have some nice diagrams about it, and it looks like, wow, this is really complex. This is going to take a revolution in corporate culture. And my advice to someone who thinks that way is don't. It's actually quite simple. You can actually start immediately. And I was explaining this to a junior designer the other day, because he was working in a project where he was not getting any requirements. He was just being given these screens to implement. He didn't know what he was doing them for. And I asked him, I said, well, did you ask for requirements? And the product manager said, we don't need requirements. I know what we need to do. So I worked with him on brainstorming requirements, because that's part of the design process, is that you need a requirements document. So we're going to do that. We're going to go back and we're going to get all those missing documents. So how do we do it? We make a list of requirements, and then he takes them to the product manager and he says, you know, I was thinking what you said about requirements, and I get that you know all that, but I really need to know it too. It's kind of how I work. So I kind of brainstormed here these requirements about what I think we're doing, what we need, and what this and what I'm working on needs to do. And I'd like to share it with you and let me know what you think. And they'll look at it, and the product manager said, but you're missing this. And the next thing you know, they're having a discussion on requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. You mentioned your articles and the diagrams you have in it. So if now people got interested in it and want to learn a bit more about that, where can they find more details about the process phases that we just talked about?
Go to the Keen website. So mm-hmm. that would be keen.design. We have a .design domain. And if you go to blogs, that's where all of our articles are.
Great. Yeah.
And there's a lot more there than just value-driven design. And also, if you want to share my contact information, I'd be more than happy to talk with people and discuss the nitty-gritty details.
Yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I will share. So we will share the contact details and also the link to the blog posts, of course, in the show notes, and people can start the discussion from there. So take it from there and go a bit more into the details. Okay, so some final words, advice for our listeners that we maybe couldn't touch on during our talk so far. Is there anything you would give as an advice for everyone?
I think there is a tremendous amount of push to dumb down design. Hmm. I think AI is also a big guilty party in that. And I think if anything, AI is actually showing the opposite, the importance of design. And what's going to differentiate an AI design from a designer is their design professionality. AI cannot apply Nigel Cross's designerly way of thinking. It can't be the reflective practitioner that Donald Schoen has envisioned. It can't reframe the question with the CEO. So you look at what's going to create what longevity in your career. It's going to be staying to the roots of being a good designer and following good, solid design practice. And that includes the design process. And that actually is what is our differentiating factor. And that's something no AI tool can replicate. And what you'll find is that this design process, it's good for products. I mean, it's a good product design. It's good for services. It's also designed for services, but it's also meant to scale. So what you can be designing can start growing more and more higher into the strategic level, because, I mean, let's face it, probably pixel pushing is not long as for a career, just like graphic design is no longer a major career. So, but where are we needed more than ever? That's still going to be in the strategic designing business and designing solution area.
Yeah, that's really encouraging advice, because there are many discussions going on about the future of our profession and such. So strategic thinking is definitely the important topic which keeps us our place at the table. Yeah.
Just really quickly too. Yeah, it's like we're being pushed to dumb things down, to simplify it, to make it more easily understandable, when we should be doing the opposite. Mm. I mean, it shouldn't be easy, because what we're doing is very hard. Designers have a unique skill set. We have a unique ability to look past stakeholders and see the questions behind the questions. And that's the whole point is we can see things that they can't. And the moment that we start saying, no, we're just like you, then what do we need you for?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. So thanks a lot. This has been really a thoughtful and super insightful masterclass, I would say.
Oh, thank you.
Really great. It was really great to get your inspiring thoughts again and learn, of course, about the process in much more detail. And thanks for your brilliant advice again. And as I said, we will share all the details and contact details in the show notes. And thank you so much for being my guest today. It was a pleasure again.
You're welcome. And I hope to do it again. I love to nerd out on design.
Great. Yeah, definitely we will do that. Hopefully not only in 2 years, maybe earlier.
Right.
I hope so, yes. All right. And thanks also to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in today to this deep dive episode of Lead UX, the Leader UX Leadership Circle. And talk to you soon. Thank you, and bye-bye.
Bye.